I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with a Deal, and today our guest is Julie Jones, the chair of the law firm Ropes and Gray. Julie, thank you so much for joining us today.
It is a pleasure to be here with you. Thanks for asking me.
So we're going to talk about your career on today's podcast, how you got into the law, how you started doing private equity work, then how you transitioned into management, ultimately becoming the chair at Ropes, how you think about the job of running a large law firm, and then finally, the issue of opportunities for women in law firms such as yours. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into the law.
Love to. So we'll start with the origin story, I guess, if this was a movie series, David. So my story and the law starts with actually coming from a family of pretty modest means. And I would say I have never met a lawyer until the day that I showed up to law school and met one of my professors. They just were not a part of my upbringing, nor were, you know, investment bankers. So I share that because I didn't have a practical understanding of what lawyers did. It was impressions from books or movies or shows, like somewhere between Atticus Finch and Susan Day's character on LA Law. But, you know, that said, I saw lawyers as leaders, leaders of society and defenders of civil rights and policymakers, very action oriented. And all of that was very appealing to me, even as a kid. Like in elementary school, I decided I want to be a lawyer. And I stayed with that career path all the way through college, wanting to continue to go to law school remained my goal. I went straight through from college to law school. And here I am at Ropes and Gray, a firm that I chose when I was 23 years old back in 1993. And other than choosing my husband, it was the best decision I've ever made.
So how did you come to work at a large law firm? And then what was appealing to you about corporate work?
Yeah, as I mentioned, I actually didn't know that much about, if anything, about what practicing lawyers do. And of course, law school trains you more to be a litigator than a corporate lawyer. But the great thing about the training that you get in an elite law firm like Ropes and Gray is you spend a summer, sometimes two, trying a lot of different things. So for me, that was really instructive. So when I got to Ropes, I tried a lot of different things, not only as a summer associate, but then coming back to Ropes and Gray. And that helped me understand that corporate was the world for me. You know, I think about working with business clients with respect to their goals as being invigorating. You have the opportunity to guide entities to outcomes that are really, really important to their strategy, to their growth. It's achievement oriented, and that appealed to me. The teaming that comes with corporate law was really, really fun. So I would just say this, I was hooked. I was hooked from the time that I started at Ropes and Gray to become a corporate lawyer.
And then at the beginning of your career, maybe the first 10 years or so, you had a broad generalist corporate practice. So talk about that practice earlier in your career and then the transition to one more focused on private equity.
Yeah, I feel really lucky that when I started, which was 30 years ago at Ropes and Gray, that it was common to do all sorts of different work in the corporate arena. So I did a lot of IPOs, I did debt financings, I represented colleges and universities, mutual funds, I worked with endowments, I did public company advisory work. I mean, every project was different. I did do some M&A, but no private equity M&A. So I learned a lot of different things. Every project had a different set of skills that were important to doing things well for our clients. But notwithstanding trying everything, I would say this. There is nothing like a big shift in the economy to hone your senses about what the things are that you need to do and where to be agile. More specifically, mostly I did IPOs, mostly in my first 4 to 5 years. And then we hit the year 2000 and a very substantial disruption to the capital markets, particularly in the tech space. And here I was, a lawyer who probably more than 50% of my time was doing tech IPOs. And I needed to toggle and pivot pretty darn fast. And that toggle moved more into M&A and eventually into private equity. But what I learned from that period, and I'm sure this happened with you and in your career, you hit these moments where you realize that careers aren't linear. How could they be? Like, a lot of us are at this for 40 or so years. Things are going to change. How you apply your skills in any market has to shift for you to be successful. And so, notwithstanding the fact that those moments are really hard when you go from having such a huge portion of your work being, in my case, in a certain area of law, and then needing to redeploy yourself, that's not unique to law. It happens to every professional. So how I dealt with that moment was breathing deep, realizing that I had a set of skills that could be applied to things outside that confine of professional expertise. And then honestly, I networked like crazy internally. I was an associate at Ropes and had a great reputation, I think, for elbow grease and skill. So I started walking door to door, talking to partners about the projects that they were leading, how I could help on them since the capital markets were soft. And there were a few partners in the PE group who gave me the career opportunities of a lifetime. And that was doing what I would describe as pure private equity acquisition work.
And so talk about the transition in your career to doing more and more of that work, and then your work on the SunGard transaction.
Yes. When I started working more in private equity work, a lot of it was with Bain Capital and Silver Lake. And again, like, thanks to the support of some pretty incredible partners, I felt like I was working with icons, you know, like Steve Pagliuca and Jonathan Levine and Josh Bekenstein and Todd Abrecht. Those are Bain Capital, and then THL with Todd Abrecht, and at Silver Lake with Egon Durbin and Greg Mondre and others. I use those names only because the opportunity to work with people that are that smart and that rigorous, who are at the best of their game, there's thrill. There is thrill to it. And so I started doing some M&A work with that client base, and I was good at it, and I earned their trust. And the one thing that I always, always advise colleagues here is, if you really enjoy something, it shows, and those clients become loyal to you. And in my case, they did. I had the opportunity to work probably more with Silver Lake than any other private equity fund in my late years as an associate and as an early partner. But it did lead me to this call by Egon Durbin. I was a very young partner, and he said something effective, "Julie, do you keep a toothbrush in your office? I have a deal for you," and asked me to lead the acquisition of a company called SunGard, which I wasn't familiar with at the moment that he called me, nor was I familiar with the size of that company or the purchase price. But I sure as heck knew that there wasn't a fund out there that could have written an equity check big enough to buy a company of that size. And I say all that because I saw that career opportunity to lead a great deal, to advise an extraordinary PE fund, including as they built out an equity syndicate. But there were a lot of moments of doubt. To paint a picture, I was a second-year partner. I had a three-year-old and a one-year-old at home. And there was a moment that I went home after maybe week one saying, like, I just can't do this. I don't know that I have the ability to build teams big enough to see the issues clearly enough that I can guide. And I'll never forget it. It was my biggest cheerleader, my husband, Mark, who's like, of course you can. And I say that because I bet we all have moments of self-doubt. I certainly did. And partly having people around you who give you that positive reinforcement when you need it to say, you can do this, like, get back into the game tonight or tomorrow, is very, very important to having a career in which you can tackle very difficult moments. But that project was by far the most memorable one of my life. Why? It was building an equity syndicate unlike any that had ever been created, other than RJR Nabisco buying the biggest company that had been purchased by a private equity syndicate. And there were no playbooks. We were writing them. We were writing the first interim investors agreement. We were writing merger agreements that had terms that had never been contemplated at the time. They included the reverse termination fee. That was the first M&A agreement for private equity that had that term. And the opportunity to create new technology, it's rare as a lawyer. And we knew we had it. We knew we had it here at Ropes & Gray. And I should note, even though you're kindly asking me about my leadership of that deal, never could have done it without the teamwork of Ropes & Gray and amazing, amazing partners around me to pull that off. But I remember the morning, I think I was literally sitting on the floor of my office with some other people saying, hey, the way to do this, the way to get this deal across the line is to have certainty in the form of a reverse break fee, because the seller was understandably in a position of feeling some anxiety about their exposure in selling to a PE firm that had created a new code to undertake the acquisition. But writing the words on a page, David, were exciting, knowing that we had an angle on something that could really define the private equity industry was thrilling.
And just to provide a little context for listeners, so SunGard was a roughly $10 billion buyout in 2005. At the time, it was one of the largest buyouts ever, and I believe the largest since that of RJR Nabisco in the late 80s. And one of the things that made SunGard so challenging was that a consortium of seven private equity sponsors teamed up to buy the company because no single private sponsor could write an equity check that large. So it was a truly groundbreaking deal. And it also kicked off an intense two-year flurry where there were a number of large private equity transactions that really redefined that industry. So then talk about your career after SunGard and kind of the springboard that that deal provided for you.
You are right. It was groundbreaking in every way imaginable. It was a moment where you could see the sophistication of the private equity industry, what they could accomplish, the kind of companies they could hold, which it was not imaginable before a deal like that got accomplished. And I didn't see it in the moment when Egon made the call to me. I could see it immediately afterwards. And in the two-year flurry is a great way of describing it. We may even say a frenzy to buy a company using those techniques, combining forces with funds, having a different level of certainty in your financing, in addition to these break fee innovations that helped private equity funds and the sellers get comfortable with it. But your question was about how did I use that as a career springboard? It partly goes back to networking. Network like crazy. As you mentioned, the syndicate for that deal included the most critical funds in the world, including Silver Lake and Bain Capital and KKR and Blackstone and TPG. And I pause on TPG because that became particularly important to me as a partner. I began working with TPG on the deals that they sent to Ropes & Gray, and I saw extraordinary opportunity. And in some ways, I used skills that helped me guide the SunGard syndicate in developing TPG as a client. And I say they're similar because it all depended on building really sophisticated teams to serve a client, to attack an opportunity. You know, what I saw with TPG was also a period of time where they were undergoing significant expansion, including in their own ambitions. I knew we could help. I thought about the talent assembly that we could offer from Ropes & Gray and kept putting us in front of them. So think about your talent, make sure a client can see it. So assemble team first. And then at the same time, make sure that you're developing a way to understand what problems that client has that you're there to solve. I don't mean litigation problems. I mean, like whatever their corporate objectives are, where do they have a gap that you can help fill? For us, we do an extraordinary amount of life sciences and healthcare M&A. I knew that that was a key area of investment opportunity. So make sure we are putting that talent in front of them. Think about where their biggest opportunities and challenges are and be positioned to meet the moment. But then you need to keep a team. And our TPG team at Ropes was well over 200 lawyers. It went from being a nascent client of the firm to our firm's points, our largest client at Ropes and Gray. You need to keep that group of lawyers and support team professionals really energized about the opportunity in a whole range of ways, you know, making everyone feel that they understand what's happening with a client, having your own internal bonding events, as well as the ones you do directly with the clients. You just need to think about what the human experience is. And working with every private equity client is demanding. Their jobs are demanding, and what we need to deliver is extraordinarily hard. So you need to make sure that your team feels really good about what they're doing. So I stayed very focused on that, what the purpose was, especially for Ropes and Gray, in building a client like that from a nascent client to an extraordinarily important client at the firm.
So talk about the challenge of building a team internally at Ropes to service TPG and what you enjoyed about that, and then how ultimately that led you to the next step in your career, which was becoming the chair of your law firm.
Gosh, you know, building the TPG team was one of the funnest projects of my career. And it's funny, you know, we often think about the partner talent team, which I certainly did. How do you get these component pieces? And it's not just M&A and debt and tax and benefits. It's healthcare experts and technology experts. All of that was really, really valuable. David, interestingly, I think it was other parts of Ropes and Gray which proved to be very important to the glue of that client relationship. Our paralegals, creating a dedicated set of them, were the ones who drafted systems playbook for a client that needed all of the resources that an elite firm could bring. Like, how can you provide billing support? So it was building this multi-layered team and making sure that they were all synced up. One of the things that we did very early on, as you talk about problems that clients have, managing legal fees is a significant issue. Our service is, it's a high value service, and we need to treat it as a very, very important aspect of our relationship. I say all that because we created legal project management roles at Ropes. I mean, this was 10 years ago. Their only job was to be monitoring whether we were running work streams efficiently. Were we giving good information to the client about where the run rates were? Were we aligned with where we were spending money and what they saw as their most critical need? There was no other firm doing something like that at the time. And we combined it into a total package of service offering to them. It just reminded me that the big things really matter, like getting the complement of partner talent right and your associate teams motivated. You need all these other puzzle pieces if you're going to do it at, you know, at the level of Olympians, which many of our clients absolutely need and warrant from us. But, you know, the lessons from whether it's a big project like SunGard or from building a team at Ropes to serve TPG and the things I learned from people at TPG and Bain Capital and others, all of it helped me become a CEO. And then I would say it's not only those things, it's also actually my IPO days, David, were incredibly valuable to me in my CEO role. I think back to that work even, and think about the work of a lawyer working on an IPO. They need to tell a growth story. They need to understand the business. They need to understand the growth story of that and how to tell that story to people. They know how to digest financial statements fast and describe them in a compelling way. They need to pull all-nighters and have good humor after them. Look, those are lessons that I use many, many days as the head of Ropes and Gray. But getting back to the more recent experience of teamwork with very large projects or with TPG, what it taught me is that everything depends on your talent model. And to the extent that you are doing anything in your life that depends on you and you alone, your success is fundamentally limited because we only have so much time in the day. Even the most skilled human will not have the capacity to have the sort of reach that you need to if you are a great leader. Some of the best advice I ever got was, I think it was a first year partner, and I got an Upward review. And there were a couple of associates that were critical of me, and probably deservedly so, that I was too demanding, put too much stress on them, and among other justifiable feedback. And the head of our firm at the time, Brad Malt, my predecessor, came to my office and said, "Julie, your success is going to depend on whether the people around you believe in you and whether they will take the hill because they're loyal to you. Pay attention to those relationships, invest in them nonstop." And you know, that was in the context of just being a, you know, a general deal lawyer at the time. But I think about it regularly as the leader of Ropes and Gray. I can't run Ropes well unless I have an extraordinary COO, unless I have someone extraordinary thinking about partner talent and partner hiring. It's all these component pieces. And the lesson is, it is never all about the CEO. It's all about the CEO who can judge and build talent around them.
So talk about the transition from being a lawyer working on a specific deal, drafting a document, negotiating, doing all the things we associate with a corporate lawyer, the transition from that to being a manager with a much broader perspective, which clearly you found enormously energizing. But of course, as you move to that second role, you can't continue to be the lawyer who was focused on every aspect of the document. So how do you make that transition? And how did you realize that you had to hand things off?
Yeah, I've often found that for me, and be really candid, it's feeling like I am forced to do those things out of necessity. I don't like to easily let go of things that are important to me, including the relationships that I have and the role that I'm playing there. Two observations about my transition into the chair role. One, I had a long transition period. It was 2 years and I needed it. I was a 48-year-old M&A lawyer with a really active practice, and I needed time between being announced as the next leader of the firm and making sure that client teams were well positioned for me not spending as much time. So the time helped. It gave me planning opportunity. It gave me the ability to have client conversations that didn't feel urgent. They were longer term in nature. I would also say that the pandemic, so I took over as the chair of Ropes at the beginning of 2020. And of course, like most institutions, we had to move to a fully remote environment by, you know, roughly the second week of that March. So I had about 10 weeks on the job. Even some of that was spent on this massive disruption planning. That took all of my time. The moments felt fraught with risk. In some ways, I was forced to let go of the familiar, which is the deal counseling, jumping in on those projects, leading the relationship building. Ropes and Gray and its people demanded every moment of my time. And what I found should not have surprised me, which is that people rise to the occasion. And while we all have this instinct of how valuable we are, because we are, to the many things we do with our careers, if you can let go, people will perform in a really extraordinary way. And that is what I saw in my colleagues. And boy, did I need them. It's funny, these strange or these unexpected encounters that you have in life prove sometimes to be amongst the most valuable. And one for me was a meeting with Lloyd Blankfein, who spoke at a Ropes event. It was maybe early 2019, so the year before I was chair. And he and I were talking, and I asked him about crisis management, because of course, he did such a terrific job of leading Goldman during the great financial crisis. And so it seemed like a throwaway question at the time when I said, if I confronted a crisis like that, what should I focus on? He said, there's three things: communication, communication, communication. Like the first thing I did is toggle to having these intense partner meetings that allowed us to stay focused and connected as a group. And he gave me several examples of how he reset the way they were communicating as a group of partners and as a firm. And it was absolutely the playbook that I used, moving from, I sat a partner updates we gave regularly, which was, I'm sure, consistent with what other firms do. To even though we have 300 partners, we talked at least every other week. That was one of his things about communications. You have to be transparent, including about what is worrying you. So I share that as both, you know, a reminder to your audience about the critical nature of communications at all times, but especially when things are difficult, and the fortuity of these opportunities you have to meet people and what you learn from them that may become very, very important to you. You know, moments of your life that are unexpected, and the conversation with Lloyd was one of those. You asked about the transition of leading deals to running an enterprise, because Rips is a $3 billion revenue organization. We have 3,000 people. And I think that one of the terrific things about being in a professional services firm and in a partnership model is that the service instinct that guided me to be successful as a practicing lawyer, you can apply that as a leader. Like, my job is to serve the firm and to serve our partners. And there's a lot of them. I have a lot more partners than I had clients, but the instincts are the same, which is, for me at least, as a style of leadership, I'm here to help them. And so, you know, you just think about, okay, if my job is to help this firm succeed and our partners succeed, how do I deploy my time to do that? And one of the things that I did early on is realize that the client focus of the firm needed to become more intense. This was, you know, in my transition period, David, and that I had a role to play there, including being on the road, constantly meeting clients of the firm. It was during 2019, I think I met with maybe 120 clients of the firm. It was nonstop. I had a blog that I used to share with all of our partners everything that I was learning from any client, because it gave you a sense of where strategies were headed, where we were succeeding, where we needed to be positioned. It was called J2Day. And it really allowed me not only to stay close to clients and I hope set an example for our partners of how much you need to do as a listening tour to understand our business and to stay close, but it was critical in me setting some areas of strategy of the firm. It's like a shorthand guide to setting a vision and a business strategy is just listening to your customers a lot. And in this case, our customers are our clients. So just a few thoughts of one, what I was doing with my transition time, where some of the most important lessons came from during that period. And the last observation also comes from a meeting that had some fortuity to it, which was meeting Billie Jean King, you know, tennis icon, who gave me advice, said, you're going to have some moments that you are going to feel under pressure. And that comes with having a job that's important. And when you feel really weighed down by it, your self-talk needs to be pressure is privilege. Pressure is privilege. I say that in my head all the time. If you're feeling stressed, it's like, Jones, pressure is privilege. And it has proven extraordinarily helpful in confronting the moments where things feel hot.
Clearly, at least from the time when you were a young partner, you found it tremendously energizing. You've mentioned a couple of examples in the course of this conversation to talk to business people. And obviously, every corporate lawyer deals with clients. Some corporate lawyers really enjoy more the technical aspects of the job. It sounded like you found dealing with your clients really energizing. At what point could you see yourself doing what they did in the sense that you would be running a business?
I saw myself as a leader, and how I applied those skills was different based on where I stood in my career. There were points where I was guiding a practice group. There were points when I was guiding a really large client relationship and initiative. It did become clear to me that I could be helpful in leading the firm. And what gave me the set of skills to do it? It was a whole set of life experiences. And you're right, like having a firsthand look at the way other CEOs were running their businesses, whether they were the heads of large investment funds or tech companies or life sciences, pharma companies. Talking to all of them just gave me a set of ideas on how to run a business. And many of them I have written down, David, and I'm an avid reader of business leadership books. Those gave me ideas. So you have all these inputs swirling in your head. But then the most important thing is a sense of knowing the enterprise and the people that you will lead. There's no denying that for me, having 30 years of experience at Ropes & Gray gives me a pretty good sense of what I need to do to help, as well as a sense of confidence that my partners will help me when I need help. And I'll give you an example. So in the first quarter of 2020, I wasn't sure whether Ropes or any enterprise was going to make it through. But in particular, law firms, who are all cash businesses, no retained earnings, our money runs out, we can't pay our people, and very challenging things can happen. So I'm deciding to draw our entire credit line so that we get through a liquidity crunch. And the decisions felt weighty. I thought I was looking into an abyss. And I remembered one practice that even in the depth of 2020, like late March, one practice that was thriving the entire time was asset management, because they were confronting these same issues. And our head of that practice called me as their demand numbers were incredibly strong. And he said, "Julie, I'm sure you're worried. I want you to know we've got this." Like, meaning our asset management practice was so strong, it could help the entire firm weather moments of disruption. And it's moments like that, as my position of chair, while I may have a role to play as our CEO, I'm never alone in doing it. And I should say, it's not just our partners, it's our clients. And all of those things, like a history with the enterprise, 30-year relationships with many of my partners, caused me to be pretty confident that I know how to do it and I know how to help.
Talk about the issue of women in the law and the changes you've seen in big law in that regard over the course of your career, which of course could be a whole podcast on its own.
Just call whenever you want me to do the sequel to it. So when I started at Ropes, women in the law, especially in elite law, were not common. Even when I became a partner of the firm in 2003, less than 20% of Ropes partners were women. And now we have a third women equity partners, and that's industry leading, and it's not enough. But I also recognize the progress that we have made during a period of time that came with a lot of intention. Intention in the form of making sure that we have the pipeline, right, David? Like, we had a very strong associate base coming in, that we were making sure women were well positioned in business cases for partnership. That's what I mean by pipeline. It's, you know, get them in, help them succeed as associates and counsel, and then make them partners. The thing I am focused on now when I think about women's careers in the law is how to have them have explosive careers, how to cause them to be the powerhouses of client relationships. And what I am reminded of is that you can never let up in making sure that groups that have had backgrounds of disadvantage when it comes to success in certain fields, you can't just leave them as a new partner and assume all is good from there. You need to stay equally focused at making sure that those colleagues have positions to lead clients like PPG or so many others. And how do you do that? Absolutely, part of it's about intention, saying this is a goal. Another thing that you need to do is ask clients for help. And I have been unafraid to do that. I'll give you an example. Many clients would call and say, "Do you have an M&A lawyer that has XYZ specialty, and I would love it if it's a woman. No, we don't. But you know what we have? We have the world's leading CFIUS and trade export lawyer, who is a diverse woman in our DC office. So my point is guiding clients to where you have talent and asking them to give that talent a shot is something that we are very, very focused on. And, you know, listen, we also need to make sure we are giving great feedback to all of our lawyers, but our partners too. I think a lot of law firms, when people reach the partnership mark, they sort of like the great abyss, like go forth and conquer and sort it out. Our approach is different. Professionals need development, even as equity partners. They need coaches. They need colleagues around them, giving them candid and quick feedback about their performance to make it better. We need the help of partners giving that sort of feedback too. So there's still a lot of work to do. And while I'm proud of how far we've come, it definitely is not enough yet.
And looking back at your description of your own career, you said that even as an associate, when IPO started to dry up in 2000, you were very willing to go to your corporate partners, probably most of whom were men, and ask for work. You know, you were an aggressive networker, certainly as a young partner. That's a skill that to some extent can be taught, but often isn't. So talk about how you help associates and partners develop that skill.
Well, the first step is storytelling, saying, hey, this is a part of what I recommend you do to be a successful professional in any form. It is build relationships and introducing yourself and being willing to ask for help. So you storytell it. You give people catchphrases to keep in the back of their mind. One of the ones that I like to remind people about is everyone at this firm wants you to succeed. And here's what I mean. I think at any point in your career, you worry and you wonder how to do more, how to attract more clients, how to get better at whatever skill set is an area of strength for you. It feels really different if on top of that, you remind yourself that you're in an institution of people who really want you to succeed. And it takes the edge off. Like, yes, maybe it's a little bit intimidating to walk into a partner's office as a mid-level associate and say, I could use some help because my workflow has dried up, until you pause and say, wait, that partner wants me to be great. They want me to succeed. So in I go. So there is something to catchphrases and not only storytelling, but modeling behavior by not waiting for your colleagues to ask either. So the impetus can't just be on the people who need help. You have to remind all of your colleagues to offer it to themselves. Try to look around corners, see where people's practices may be disrupted, whether it's a market shift or, you know, a client gets bought and someone needs to get redeployed. Look for those opportunities. And I would say not only should all our partners be doing that, but our structure has a number of practice group leaders who can see it, who can see it and try to redeploy people strategically. I do think that so much of our success as professionals comes from your willingness to put yourself out there in lots of different ways. You know, in my case, it was asking for help in a moment of big market shift. It was certainly asking for the help of my ropes colleagues to grow a massive relationship. It's also asking clients for help in a lot of different ways and thinking like the worst thing that people could say to you is no. And once you ask a few times and people say no, you realize life goes on and a lot of people jump in to help you. So it's ask, 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 and do so based hopefully on a relationship that you've spent some time cultivating even before the ask. That is an important part, is to make sure that you are spending some time learning people, helping them. And I think all of those things are fundamental to building not just a good practice, but a great one.
And then finally, you mentioned your husband a couple of times on the podcast. You mentioned your kids were at the time were tiny when Egon Durban called on the SunGard deal. Talk about how you keep some kind of life outside of work with what is clearly a really demanding job.
Yes, you're right. The job is very intense. Leading a business of this size, or really any size, is intense. So is the job of our partners. And partly I say to myself, like, someday I'll watch Breaking Bad. It is not a priority for me. I actually went in the other direction a bit on this one. Instead of thinking about having a separate personal life and a Ropes and Gray life, pull your family in to the extent you can into your professional world. Make your partners your friends. Invest in relationships there so it doesn't feel as segmented. We have a lot of family events. This is one of the things I've changed about Ropes and Gray, making sure a lot of our events have family orientation, including for clients. Those things are really, really memorable. Go with a client to see Taylor Swift. Great. They'll have a really good time. You take a client and their child to see Taylor Swift, you have a friendship for a long, long time. So I would say this, like, resist the segmentation. All of that said, of course, we all need lives outside of the world of our workplace. And one of the things that I learned early on and advise people to do is to prioritize the things that are really important to you and do not sacrifice them. For me, there's several family traditions. Like, I'm just coming off this massive July 4th celebration at my home that we've been having for as many years as I can remember, with family members, friends, huge backyard barbecue, every bed, couch, sleeping space in my house taken. Like, I will never miss that. And nor did I ever miss the shows that my kids were in. Like, they both did theater, and I just never missed one. That was really, really important to me. And the reason I say don't sacrifice those is living life as a martyr is really hard, and it leads to you feeling quite unhappy. And if you've prioritized the things that are the most important to you and don't lose them, I think you bring down that tension. I also think you need to make decisions about what isn't fundamental to you.
Watching Breaking Bad, not fundamental.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Maybe I feel a little grumpy. Everyone's talking about this great show. Everyone seems to know about it and be able to talk about it. How much do I care about, like, following those series? Not that much. And even in your family life, there's a division that sometimes you can realize there are things as a parent that are fundamental to you, and there are ones where you actually don't think being there is as important to your relationship. Like, a lot of people take great joy out of feeding their families. I mean, like, cooking for them, the experience of cooking, and I respect that. That is not something that appeals to me. I'm terrible at it. And luckily, my husband is great. So I've never felt bad about not being that person, like that type of parent. I just deprioritized it and I don't feel bad about it.
Julie, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was great to be here. I look forward to the next podcast on Women in the Law. Whenever you want me for that, I am here for you. But I would say this, thank you not only for the opportunity to talk with the audience that you have today, but for all of the work that you've been doing. Your personal writing has been critical to my understanding of the marketplace and in the PE world almost for as long as I've been a private equity lawyer. So I appreciate your excellence and what it's meant to me as a professional as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Julie. For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Martins. Mm-hmm.